This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, autism was first named and diagnosed 75 years ago, and it was believed to be a rare condition. In recent years, ideas about autism have changed a lot, and the number of people diagnosed with what we now call autism spectrum disorders has grown at a startling rate. John Donvan and Karen Zucker are journalists for ABC and the authors of a new book called In a Different Key. It's a history of the condition and a study of how people are affected by it. Now, this is a subject I follow with particular interest. I've got a teenage daughter who's profoundly affected by autism. And the subject is also very, very personal for John Donvan and Karen Zucker.
I have a 21-year-old son with autism, and I would not have written this book if I didn't have a 21-year-old son.
Where is he now? What kind of condition is he in? What's his life like?
He's a really interesting guy. I would say he was always on an upward track until this year. He's at a special program in Arizona called Chapel Haven West, which is for life skills and living skills off the university. And this is his third year. He's coming home in June for good. And he's capable of flying there by himself after years and years of practice. But if any sort of curveball were to happen, if anything out of order, it could be somewhat disastrous.
A lost ticket, a late flight.
Yeah, I mean, he usually does not land with his ID or anything that he went on the plane with. But he gets there. So he's a good traveler, but he can't manage himself. He will need support for his life in order to just make sure that he eats and buys the right food. And he's working on all of that, but he does not have it down.
And John, what's...
I married into the autism community, quote unquote. My wife grew up in Israel, in Tel Aviv, with a younger brother, year and a half younger, who was born in the late 1960s and diagnosed at the age of about three with autism at a time when the diagnosis was considered a very rare thing. And when the advice her mom was given was to put her brother, whose name is Dol, into an institution, and her mom went and looked at the institution, it was horrible. And she actually, as a result of that, became an activist in Israel, and she built schools and built residences.
My understanding is that, I was once at a dinner seated next to the wife of a very prominent Israeli politician, and we were talking about this, and they're explaining the care that adults with autism have in Israel and some other countries, and it's markedly better than what we have here.
Well, because we have...
next to nothing.
Thank you for saying that.
Next to nothing. I know it all too.
No, it's challenging because all of our kids grow up to be adults, and we haven't figured out the adult piece.
And apparently, we don't live forever.
That we know too, and it's scary. It's scary to be a parent. It's scary to know that as your child gets older, as opposed to things getting better and better. You know, there's a term people say, falling off a cliff. It's real.
What do you mean by falling off a cliff? What
happens? Turn 21. The parents in this book, the advocates, they fought to get their kids out of institutions. We talk about the civil rights, and we talk about how parents then changed the laws so that their kids could go to school. Well, that's their protection until they're 21, is that the law says they have the right to an education. And at 21, the law doesn't give them anything.
Now, we hear that the prevalence of autism, not so long ago it was 1 in 120, and now it's 1 in 68. What are these statistics in your mind reflecting? Is it a greater ability, a keener ability, a greater willingness to diagnose people with Asperger's autism somewhere on the scale, or is it increasing in fact?
Well, autism is now a spectrum. It's called the autism spectrum.
Sure.
And over the years and decades, we keep changing the definition of what autism is, and we keep broadening the definition. And so each time we count how many people we are, we're counting apples and oranges. We're not counting the same thing anymore. We also, as a society, are much more aware of autism than we ever were before. And that makes people more willing to sort of own up to it.
Do you think there's sometimes some overdiagnosis when you hear some – I constantly hear, and maybe my ears are specially tuned to this as yours are, but when I hear somebody sort of flippantly say, oh, he or she, kind of on the spectrum, there's something – this has entered the language that at any kind of behavior that's a little –
quirky.
Unusual mm-hmm. or quirky, somehow the spectrum is invoked.
Well, that's what's happened, is that we have made the spectrum so large that you have such extreme ends of it that, you know, we sort of think down the road it will break apart again, and maybe we'll start to look at things like different types of autisms. And it is not one spectrum, because you can't call the person who's banging their head against a wall or who can't care for themselves the same guy who has a PhD. They have something that's so incredibly different. And, you know, as a parent, I feel that it complicates things.
So you have written about, as one of the centerpieces of this book, the man who's known as patient number one. Leo Kanner identified a child named Donald Triplett as autistic in his early paper in the 30s. He's still alive. You know him. And how did your relationship with Donald inform this book?
Well, we set out to find Donald. There were archival medical records that we were able to find. And so then we needed to find Donald to see if we could get access to them. And John and I sort of set out to do some investigative reporting. And we knew he was in Forest, Mississippi.
That's because Leo Kanner left a lot of clues throughout the medical speeches he gave here and there. And at one point, he mentioned this town, Forest, Mississippi.
So I started calling all the T's in Forest.
That's because, again, we need to explain that the medical literature did not give Donald's last name. Mm-hmm. He was described as just Donald T. Dash. So we had the first letter of his last name.
Right. And there weren't a lot of Donalds, but there were a lot of T's. And, you know, it wasn't that many down the line, about 15 calls in.
How big a town is Forest, Mississippi?
About 3,500.
Yeah, it's not a huge place, but I got lucky that it didn't take weeks. And I call this number and I get this answering machine. And it says, hello, happy spring and happy fall and have a wonderful Christmas and welcome to 2007. And I hang up the phone and I call John. We got him. This is Donald. I know this is Donald. We absolutely have found the guy.
Yeah.
And
that comes from personal experience.
That's probably the most I ever heard him speak at one time, was on the answering machine, because he's not chatty. He is our friend.
He's 80.
He's 82. Mm-hmm. And he has traveled the world. He learned how to drive when he was 27.
Cares for himself?
Yes. He lives in the same home that he grew up in. But he also has this town called Forest, Mississippi, that has completely embraced him. And John and I believe that a lot of his success has been growing up in a place where people have watched out for him his whole life and embraced him and just made him one of them.
I assume that there are many parents out there who are listening who have children on the autism spectrum, and certainly everybody knows somebody. And the interest in this is thankfully rising all the time. What hope is there in terms of therapies, in terms of maybe the word shouldn't be cure, but an analysis? Where is the research heading in autism?
The research primarily is going in the direction of studying the genetics of autism. That's a field where the deeper they get in, the more complicated they believe it's going to be. As Karen said before, we may find that there are so many different pathways to this condition, which really is defined by rather subjective observation of people's behaviors. It might turn out that there are many, many kinds of autisms. But we're very, very far away from that. I don't think we're at a point where in our lifetime we're going to figure out what causes autism. We do know that behavioral treatments, which are very intense and very expensive, can ameliorate some of the more limiting behaviors. But I think our thought on putting our hope for the solution to the predicament and dilemma of severely affected people on science and cures is maybe not the right focus. The focus we really think needs to be – if our book has an argument, it's that society needs to find a better way not to be jerks towards individuals with autism. Find a space for them, a place for them in society. Make it easier.
Karen, where should activism push?
You know, I don't I think that John sort of nailed it in the sense of acceptance. And I can speak to that. My son who on some levels is competent but on most levels really struggles. He tried to get on a plane last summer and he didn't make eye contact with the woman on the floor while he was getting his ticket. And she tried to prevent him from flying and she went and got his supervisors and it became this ordeal where, you know, I just sort of said, go. You didn't do anything wrong. You have a right to fly. Just go. And he got himself through. And the next thing I knew, this woman who's working at the counter is chasing after him as if he's some sort of terrorist, literally, to bring him back from flying on an airplane. So we really have a lot of work to do on the most basic level.
Of awareness.
I mean, we feel like we've come far. We're not locking people up in institutions. That's fantastic. Our kids get to go to school. That's great. But as a society, there are pockets of acceptance.
Kids of real kindness on the street and in a store.
Absolutely, but it is kids. And my son's 21 now, and they wouldn't have stopped him as a kid. But as a you know, 6-foot skinny guy who doesn't shave very well.
People are freaked out.
Yeah,
they don't really know how to react.
They really are. And that would be the goal.
Thank you both. I really appreciate it. I appreciate more than I can tell you the book itself. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Karen Zucker and John Donvan, the authors of In a Different Key.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.